The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. There is one industry that seems to be completely recession-proof, and that is the arms industry, the arms business. And the United States, for all of our preoccupation about arms limitations agreements, about non-proliferation, rather, of nuclear weapons, for all of our desire to see to it that the nations of the world are not resolving their conflicts with war, the United States remains one of the biggest traffickers in arms. I have said recently there must be some method of thinking, some thought process of people high in the circles of government, the State Department in particular, or the Pentagon, that their reasoning must be far advanced to ours in that they can send millions upon millions of dollars worth of modern sophisticated weaponry to Arabs surrounding Israel. The recent sensational announcement of the shipments of 750 million worth of F-5s to Saudi Arabia is a case in point. And as I mentioned recently also, there have been some of the super sophisticated helicopters that are attack helicopters able to operate in virtual zero-zero weather. Even some of the best of America's newer Spruance-class destroyers that are slated for delivery to Gulf sheikdoms. And, of course, our tremendous pouring of arms into Iran, including the F-14s, a super-sophisticated aircraft that is even a couple of generations above the F-4. And so, when you look at it all, the stage is being set for some awfully important things to happen in one of the most complex and one of the most dangerous areas on the face of the earth, and the United States is right in the middle of it all, with supplying arms to those hostile enemies around Israel, and enemies who are even hostile toward each other. And as you look at the Middle East and you wonder who is hating who these days, and who is plotting against who, and who is arming who, you can't just say, well, the Soviet Union is arming the Arabs. Now the United States is also arming the Arabs. And the one great recession-proof industry is the arms business. And it seems to be alive and well in the Persian Gulf area. Now there are headlines in Western papers about the contract that is being scrambled over by two leading aero firms in the United States, builders of a new aircraft, which it is hoped the United States Air Force, the Navy, one or the other, maybe both, are going to take up as a contract. But there's no real worry about even that, because there will be significant sales abroad of this airplane. And so, of course, in our free enterprise system of competition, it doesn't really seem to matter anymore who we sell these things to. You know, the other day I got a nasty letter in the mail. I had mentioned somewhere along the way, as I was talking about the automotive industry, that I drove a Volkswagen. Some lady sent me a letter. She said, "Shame on you for driving a foreign car when our nation is in such trouble. You should buy American and proudly display your bumper sticker to buy American." Isn't that incredible? Oh, boy, I'm telling you. Well, why don't we sell American, folks? Don't tell me to buy American when our own Navy, Army, and Air Force is unable to buy American. You know, they tell me buy American when even our military organizations come knocking at the door of some of our aerospace firms and say, "Hey, I'd like my F-14s first." And they say, "No, you guys got to wait a couple of years while we sell these to the Arabs." I've been singled out for a lot of things, but that was one of the funniest criticisms I've heard in a long time. As I look at the absolute avalanche, the absolute army of little foreign automobiles pouring into the United States. And I've commented on it since the early 1950s. For over 20 solid years, I've been decrying the fact of this virtual trade invasion, hoping that maybe we would wake up in this United States of America a couple of decades ago and begin to be able to compete with Volkswagen and Toyota. But no, we never would. Well, you know, finally, I had to kind of react to the energy crisis the same way other people did, and I was just the most patriotic guy you ever saw, and I still am, except there's a slight difference, I guess, in that my patriotism is about the same kind of patriotism of a lot of folks who decide they would rather go 21 to 31 miles a gallon instead of 6 to 9. Now, the lady wants me to get rid of my Volkswagen and buy one of these gas gulpers, and I'm not about to do it. No, I'll tell you what. The day Detroit will come out with some automobiles that will give me the same mileage and give me the same pleasure. Now, I know they're coming out with some little ones now. Finally, we're beginning to gear up. There was this statement I made sometime in the past about how Detroit had even gone, Detroit, I say, meaning a symbol for the entirety of the automotive industry, and our own government had gone to the Japanese and asked for a complete hiatus on the imports of Japanese automobiles in the United States for about a year and a half. Just stop them totally so Detroit could catch up. Now, that just isn't really the way you would think free enterprise works. That's about like one fellow who is in the manufacturing business of some small item or commodity, and he is lagging behind his neighbor, who is a top competitor and hardworking, keeping long hours and really a good marketer and so on. He's out working his tail off and really making a lot of money. And his neighbor, who's lagging behind, goes over and says, "Hold it there, Joe. Now, why don't you just stop marketing your product for about a year and a half and give me time to catch up? Let's just have good competitive spirit here." It doesn't work that way, does it? Well, I'll guarantee you one thing. You can try to buy American even if you are the U.S. Navy, and you'll find it's pretty hard to do. I think maybe the U.S. Navy is going to have to go to the Soviet Union to get their ships. And I think maybe we would be better off if we would secretly send some of our Air Force generals, dress them up like Arabs, put them in all those funny-looking tablecloths they wear for headdresses, and sit them down at a conference table and let them claim to have all of the money and the financing and so on, and see if they can buy some F-14 fighter jets. If they could disguise our Pentagon leaders as leaders in high finance in Kuwait or Abu Dhabi or Iran or Saudi Arabia, I'll bet they could get the aircraft and the ships and the helicopters and the guns they need. But as long as they keep appearing in those easily recognizable U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force and U.S. Army uniforms, our arms and munitions manufacturers know that they don't have any money. See, and they know that the Arabs do have money, so they're selling to the Arabs. So America's number one. We are number one in world trade in arms. It's unbelievable. And yet you have all of these people who like to get out in the streets and demonstrate against wars and against arms. It's amazing, though, that when it comes right down to what puts food on the table and what keeps old Joe Jones at the factory and what keeps us working, what keeps the wheels going around, it's the arms business. So the U.S. State Department says that American arms flowing in there, quote, contribute to stability, end quote, in the Middle East. The statement I liked was, after the original announcement of all those F-14s to Iran and the destroyers going to another nation and many, many tanks, over 1,000 tanks from Britain alone and hundreds more from the United States going to Iran. And then, of course, there have always been tanks going to Jordan and Saudi Arabia and other countries down there made in the United States. But now this $750 million shipment of F-5s to Saudi Arabia. What I like was the original State Department statement that was made just the other day about, I don't want you to think that this is going to contribute to any kind of an arms race in the Middle East. That was a beautiful statement. Now they're saying that it contributes rather than to an arms race to stability. But there's just an uncomfortable feeling you get out of all of this. That if Israel and her Arab neighbors, who appear to be headed toward a war, and as I talk, I'm sure there's a battle going on somewhere. Every single day we read of another border skirmish of some kind, the most recent being an attack by Israeli troops across the southern Lebanese border. And again, the interdiction of water lines and blowing up of roads leading to some of the villages out of which Arab guerrillas operate. So we know there's something going on. So even if they do manage to avoid a war in the immediate future, it looks to me that the more arms are poured in there and the more saber-rattling goes on between the big powers and the charge and counter-charge between the Arab oil producers and the United States about alleged strangulation and the use of force not being ruled out, as Mr. Kissinger said, that the stage is being set for a spark which could ignite World War III in the Middle East. And the big powers are getting involved. Now, statistics on these armies that are now being called petro-armies, meaning armies that seem to emerge right out of the desert, paid for by petrodollars. That's the dollars of the wealth of the world that is pouring into the Middle East. I showed how they had about a $5 billion surplus over what they paid for all that they needed to import in 1973. You hear that? Over $5 billion in 73. A lot of money, huh? Oh, no. Not even near what they had in 74, which soared to over $60 billion in just 1 year. That's what really happened with the quadrupling of oil prices. To have a surplus at all is a very comfortable thing nowadays, what with the terrible balance of payments deficits most countries in the Western industrialized world have incurred in the last several years. So, some of the statistics about the armies and the Air Force and so on of some of these Middle East rulers as they shop in a buyer's market for military power is a little bit mind-boggling. The world trade in arms is estimated to have hit $18 billion in fiscal 1974, and much of that, the large share of it, is going to the Middle East and the United States. The United States is the world's biggest arms supplier, and it seems anyone is welcome to come shopping. The Soviet Union, if they wanted to buy from us, if they had the money, it was cash on the barrelhead, very likely we would sell to the Soviet Union. Why not? We're selling wheat, aren't we? That's the very staff of life. It's the very national essence of our strength. Instead of putting it into our own storage bins for emergencies, for our own people, we sell it to people whose absolute, avowed, repeated, documented aim, goal, and objective is to bury us. So why not sell them arms? I mean, here we're selling arms to people who claim that they will blow up the oil wellheads and they will simply stop the flow of oil to all the Western world in the event of renewed hostilities between themselves and Israel, no matter who starts it, apparently. Some Arab leadership recently has gone on record as saying, no matter who starts it, really. If a war happens again in the Middle East, we clamp off all oil going to everybody everywhere, including Japan and all of Europe. It's a tremendous, crazy thing that's happening in the Middle East right now. And that's why I've been zeroing in on Bible prophecy to show how Bible prophecy zeroes in on the Middle East, that it figures prominently, that the big powers are identified, the smaller nations all around Israel and Israel itself are identified in the pages of the Bible, that the stage is being set for the fulfillment of some of those statements of Christ that he made nearly 2,000 years ago. When you shall see armies surrounding Jerusalem, know the desolation thereof is nigh, talking about a time in which, if there weren't divine intervention, all of human life could be annihilated. A time that we have now entered, that never could have been understood anywhere except this side of 1945, that date in August when the first atomic bomb was dropped and the world entered the atomic age. But now we can understand it. That's why recently I waded very carefully through the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation about a great military combine that is called, figuratively in the Bible, a beast, that has a great spiritual organization that is called a woman, that strides or rides or controls that beast. And you find in the 17th chapter that the city is almost, you know, it's impossible to miss which city it's talking about. We waded through that and showed exactly what the 17th chapter says about this great madam that deals in politics, that interferes in governments, that holds sway over state after state, that is not just in that sense a religious organization, but in that sense a political organization as well. And I even mentioned 2 Thessalonians 2, that shows the move of a great, prestigious religious leader into the Middle East, directly into Jerusalem, who will make tremendous statements, even claiming to exalt himself on the level with God, claiming to be God, claiming to be not necessarily human, but divine, and even having the power to call down miracles, fire from heaven, in the sight of people, to dazzle and to so enamor and to so infuse with excitement and spiritual joy and thrill with people just so excited that at last here is some great wonderful intervention from a divine source, somebody that has the power to create literal miracles, and seeing that happen before their eyes. The Bible prophesies that several things, really three major things, are going to happen all at the same time. A tremendous economic burgeoning of wealth. Even there in the 18th chapter, where that same system is described, it talks about gold and silver and all the fine jewelry. The wealth of the world being funneled into the Middle East. The Bible plainly shows that would occur. Also, over in the latter part of the book of Daniel, it shows that when war does get started there, the northern power that goes down there is going down to get its hands on wealth of the world, as well as the means of survival, and of course, as well as oil, which is the world's major energy supply. So the stage is being set. The Bible points out an economic outpouring, an outflowing of the wealth of the world in the Middle East. Then it shows there will be armies surrounding Jerusalem in the prophecies of Christ himself. And it also shows a great religious action in the Middle East. So you have all of the stage being set right now. The wealth of the world is pouring into the Middle East. The big powers of the world are arming the Middle East. many nations there buying prodigious amounts of arms with the monies they earn from their oil. It is strategically the most important part of the world. I have said, and I said it repeatedly and repeatedly, I came on the air and the opening comments I made on broadcast after broadcast during the entire decade of American involvement with Vietnam, and I could go back and get you the exact tape and let you hear it, except there would be dozens, where I said, events in the Middle East are soon going to pale into insignificance, American concern over our involvement in Vietnam. Well, that day has arrived long since, ever since the Yom Kippur War of 1973. So it's really a perplexing day in which you live, and you need to come to understand it. Now, we're coming out right away with far more information in The Plain Truth than ever before. And coming up in the first, well, it'll be a semi-monthly because it'll be twice a month now. We're coming out in tabloid, and The Plain Truth is going to be so dynamic and power-packed, you're going to scarcely be able to contain yourself when you read it, because it's the kind of straight talk that you hear right on the program, and you're going to get so much more information, shorter, more to-the-point articles, far easier to read, that are really going to clarify what's happening. Let me give you an example. Here's an article coming along in the first issue for February of our new tabloid Plain Truth, how the Middle East is on the brink of a new war, and how the threat of total embargo worries the West, how the shaky truce that the Middle East is undergoing new strains that not even Dr. Kissinger seems to be able to defuse the situation. The Israeli military remains poised for any eventuality. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat warns that the Middle East is a bomb ready to explode at any moment. Articles just such as this in every single edition. That's a fairly comprehensive article, but it's shortened to the point. You can read it just in a very few minutes. Also, the article on Who Will Feed the World's Hungry by our Washington correspondent, and resulting from recent meetings where the entirety of the world gave global attention to dramatic problems of food shortages the world over, to the advancement of the drought area there of the sub-Sahara, and to the fact that is the imminent starvation facing literally tens of millions of human beings. According to Nobel Prize laureate Dr. Norman Borlaug, the world has now come to the place where 50 million people, perhaps more, could perish from famine in a single year. And it gives you exactly what world food authorities say from the Overseas Development Council, that the world has entered into a period of more or less chronic food scarcity, and how this squares with American sales of wheat and food grains to other countries and the outpouring of our emergency supplies. Also, directly from on the spot, from Paris, at the inconclusive summit that I talked about on the broadcast between the European Economic Community leadership, which was attended by our two correspondents there, Ray Kosanke and Henry Sturkey, and their article is filed, and you will get it in the current number of The Plain Truth, coming out in its tabloid size and new form twice a month, with many, many articles every single month, 25, 30, or 40, and believe it or not, we've even got political cartoons, other types of illustrations, many pictures, and Art Buchwald's column is going to be in there, by the way. We've got that for you, too. Another article coming along is United Nations, another League of Nations by Raymond McNair. And what has the United Nations accomplished during the past 30 years? And will it last till the end of this century? I've said recently, when I saw the incredible factor of the smaller countries but having equal voice and equal vote with the United States in the United Nations, even over the protests of Western Europe, Japan, and the United States, giving UN approval to the most massive ripoff in the history of the world, that is, expropriation of foreign investments in country after country and around the world, no matter what the United States said. Meaning that little tiny nations, if they find, according to their laws, that they've allowed 46 or 49 or 51% investment by American or Japanese or West German firms, I don't know what the laws are, varying from country to country. Usually it's only about half or slightly less than half. But the point is that if they, quote, nationalize, end quote, which is a polite word for steal, those industries, as they have done in nations all over Central and South America recently and in Africa, where they simply gobble up all the capital outlay, the expenditures, the equipment, the tools, the dyes, the land, the leases, the furnishings, the vehicles, it doesn't matter what, they simply appropriated. They gave lip service to that, said that's perfectly all right, that's legal now. Well, I suggested that why doesn't the United States then expropriate the United Nations? After all, we've paid the lion's share of the costs. We have had to erect the building. We've had to protect some of the characters who have come there to speak who don't even belong there. You know, I want to just break in. I kind of interrupt myself with a thought here, but I saw something in the newspaper that I got to comment on. Apparently, some character someplace in the White House decided that the ultimate injustice would be to calculate the exact moment at which Mr. Nixon's resignation became official and find out that Air Force One was actually in the air en route to the West Coast to take Mr. Nixon, a completely beaten, whipped, discouraged, and dejected man, and growing then seriously ill, and really one of the most incredible scandals, and of course, one of the most incredible moral, mental, and spiritual defeats that could ever be handed a person at that pinnacle of power. But they decided to then calculate exactly what the operating costs of that airplane were, and then send Mr. Nixon a bill for over $8,000, which represented the distance between somewhere around Jeff City, Missouri, and the West Coast. So that even though the plane was in flight, in the air, and the plane, you know, the trip was almost halfway over, that they decided that this was a legitimate request from the federal government that Mr. Nixon should pay it as a private citizen. Well, now, okay, fine. If, you know, I don't say okay, fine. I think it is absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, that's just my opinion. But why don't we then have the city of New York, the state of New York, United Nations Special Security Police, the CIA, the FBI, all other American security organizations who provided the heaviest security in the history of any visitor to the United Nations for that squat little murderer of women and children, Yasser Arafat, and send him the bill. I should imagine it soared up into the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions of dollars, to conduct that little character around in helicopters and the like. Why should we give away money to the United Nations when a beaten and whipped man, albeit resigned from office and all that goes with it, Watergate and the rest? But now, I just don't follow the logic. I'm interrupting myself, I know, with talking about the plain truth, but I don't see these two things in proper context. If Mr. Nixon is to get a bill for the remainder of a trip, which was surely authorized, I mean, after all, the U.S. government has flown people, guests, and people from other countries around in its private jet fleet. And it has quite a large one, by the way. It isn't just Air Force One. There's a standby Air Force One. There are several smaller jets. There are Lockheed Jetstars and other aircraft like that that are used by the Vice President, other members of the Cabinet, and State Department from time to time, as well as family and friends. And it was commonplace, and nobody ever said a word about it. But suddenly they're going to try to nail Mr. Nixon with an $8,000 bill from the remainder of the trip. Well, I say, okay, that's fine. If that's the way they want to do it in the White House, I'm not quite sure that that is really the kind of morality and the kind of justice that we all want heaped upon us when Judgment Day comes. But then we at least ought to send a bill to Yasser Arafat for all the monies he cost us to provide security. Seems to me like if a guy is a murderer, he doesn't really earn any special security. That I would still warn Yasser Arafat to watch his back, because, you know, when you're a pack of dirty, rotten crooks and thieves and hoodlums and thugs and murderers of women and children, can you really trust anybody? I mean, he's got a lot of guys in his own organization that must lie to each other just to keep in practice. And I don't know if I were he, if I'd turn my back or sleep very peaceably at night, because there are too many people that, because of their own swelling, egotistical, toadish vanity, would love to replace Yasser Arafat. It was a great moment of triumph for him to be able to stand up in a podium in the United Nations General Assembly and wag his fat little finger at people, claiming to hold up a freedom fighter's pistol in one hand and an olive branch in the other. But if he'd shown up with the dismembered body of a 17-year-old girl coming from the south of the United States and had her hobble in beside him and say, "I did this, this is what I mean by my freedom fighter's pistol," maybe the world would have understood a little more clearly. If Arafat could have had a whole line of people wheelbarrowing in the dismembered legs, arms, and eyes, and ears, noses, and heads, and bodies of children and women, if he could have stood atop a pile of bodies there, and maybe a whole lot of graves all around him, with dying and shrieking and yelling and screaming kids and women, it would have been a far more accurate scenario for his visit to the United Nations. But that didn't happen. Well, so much for that comment. I couldn't help but interrupt myself when the thought came. Also coming in the current plain truth, the one on how to survive scarcity. Now, it's not really a new word, but when you look at what is happening in the country about things that are growing scarce on a really large scale, you need some good, helpful information. about practical examples of how to survive during a time of severe scarcity. That's in The Plain Truth. Also, Newsmaker Profile, an article on Takeo Miki, Japan's new man at the helm. A senior member of Japan's Diet, 67-year-old Takeo Miki, assumed the post of Japan's 12th post-war premier. And my father, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, was the very first private citizen, and I think the first American, including officials, to meet Mr. Miki after inauguration as the new premier of Japan. Food Taboos, Stronger Than Hunger, another article coming out in the February number, and my own Speaks Out column on the deadly international monetary game, Is It a Prelude to Worldwide Trade War? An article on the Bible, Is It a Contemporary Book? Many other articles and features in the new look of The Plain Truth. We found a way to beat inflation, and that is by reducing the cost of the color and the weight or the stock of the paper, and getting from somewhere around 11 cents a copy right on down to about 3 to 4 cents a copy with tabloid, and then doubling the frequency and doubling the number of articles, increasing circulation dramatically. And that's why I'm announcing it. If you want a free copy or even a couple of them and have one to give away to somebody else, be sure to write for your copy of The Plain Truth. It's absolutely free of charge. We're coming out tabloid. We're sending, by the way, complimentary copies of The Plain Truth to offices, to libraries, to schools, universities, hospitals, to people all over the United States by the hundreds of thousands. So we'd like you to get your very first copy, beginning with the February number of some of these articles I've announced, just the same kind of straight-from-the-shoulder, hard talk that you're going to hear on the World Tomorrow program. Articles about the Bible, about Christian living, about prophecy, and articles about world news directly tied in to Bible prophecy and what it means. Well, as I said at the beginning of the program, the most recession-proof business right now is the arms business. So it appears to me to be a little ironic, to say the least, to see Americans talking about nuclear non-proliferation, yet handing out nuclear reactors to Arabs and promising nuclear development of Egypt and other countries. Talking about decrying warfare between neighbors, such as Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, countries like the Middle East, yet supplying hundreds of millions in arms to those countries even before our own armed services can get those same arms. And I saw that one of our major aerospace firms in the United States was not really so terribly worried about the possible loss of a government contract that's between the Northrop Company and one other major firm, which this YF-16 or YF-15, whichever one it is, they're developing for the possible sale to the Air Force and or the Navy. They weren't really concerned about losing the contract so much because they pointed out that even if the one contract to our own one branch of the service fell through, they could always sell lots of them to other people. It's a perplexing world. We would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.